Hi, this is John Jenkins, managing editor of the corporatecounsel.net and deallawyers.com. And I'm joined once again by my co-host, J.T. Ho, who heads up ORC's public company advisory practice, for another edition of our Understanding Activism podcast. Today, we're joined by Kai Lekafet from Sidley Austin. Kai is a partner in the firm's New York office and co-chairs Sidley's shareholder activism and corporate defense practice. He has over 20 years of experience in corporate law and spends all of his time on shareholder activism, campaigns, proxy fights, and hostile takeovers. In fact, over the past 5 years, Kai's defended over 150 proxy contests globally and approximately 25% of U.S. late-stage proxy fights, and that's more than anybody else. So anyway, shortly before the election, Kai wrote a client memo that we shared on deallawyers.com discussing why activists were backing Donald Trump over Kamala Harris. Now that the dust has settled on the election, we're going to ask Kai to provide us with his thoughts on how the election might impact shareholder activism in the months and years to come. Kai, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, John.
Okay, great. JT, you want to kick things off for us?
Yeah, thanks, John. And good again to be talking with you, Kai. So let's just start with the first Trump administration. You know, many of the SEC's rulemaking actions did not work to benefit activists during that first administration. What do you see in terms of favorable changes with respect to activists, potentially with the SEC this time around?
Well, let's start by talking a bit about why activists were rooting so much for Donald Trump to be reelected as president. And that shines then also some light on your question. They, and I should be clear, not all activists supported Donald Trump, but what we've seen, a vast majority of the well-known activists were supporting Trump either publicly or at least privately and with their checkbook. That includes Tryon's Nelson Peltz, Elliott's Paul Singer, Carl Icahn, Third Point's Dan Loeb, Bill Ackman from Pershing Square, John Paulson and the like. And what they liked about Donald Trump is the fact that the tax policies were more to their liking than the proposed tax policies of Kamala Harris. In particular, they were focused on the 2017 tax cuts under the previous Trump administrations that were set to expire at the end of 2025, at least for most part. And these activists are hoping that these tax policies continue to remain in effect, that they will be extended by a Republican-controlled Congress. There's also the hope that deregulation will spark a significant amount of value created in the stock market in the United States in particular, which is why activists were also supporting Donald Trump. And lastly, they hope that he will be successful in keeping the interest rates down. Now, as we all know, or at least many of us know, the Fed is independent, but activists hope for sure that Donald Trump will put significant pressure on the Fed to continue the rate cutting that the Fed has recently begun. The only caveat from an activist perspective, and we heard some activists express that to us privately, and I'm not going to name them out of respect, is that they were very concerned about Trump's announced intent to implement universal tariffs. That terrifies certainly some fraction of Wall Street and elsewhere. And that is obviously a significant risk. But apparently, the vast majority of activists seem to be willing to take that risk of universal tariffs and similarly disruptive impacts on the economy in the United States. And I think our suspicion is that a lot of activists thrive on market dislocation. I mean, if you will, a challenging environment makes it clearer which companies are well managed and which companies are not. And sure, there are some activists who actually don't mind if there is a little bit of turmoil in the market for that reason, although I'm sure that's not a universal thought.
With respect to the SEC, you haven't touched on that yet, but I know that the SEC had adopted rules for proxy advisory firms that many companies welcomed, but activists did not. during Donald Trump's first term. These rules were later amended under the under Gary Gensler's SEC, and they're now in litigation. What changes do you expect that the SEC might make under Trump 2.0 regarding proxy advisory firms regulation, and how will these impact corporate elections and activist campaigns?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. The SEC under the first Trump administration is actually fascinating because, just generally speaking, Jay Clayton, the previous chair of the SEC, was very much pro-corporate America, pro-company, and not pro-activist. So, which is one of the puzzles you might have when you hear about activists rooting for Donald Trump, is knowing that the SEC was actually not in their camp. And the proxy advisory regulations are a perfect example that you just raised. That is something that the SEC staff, to be clear, had been working on for a very long time. One of my partners who joined us a few years ago, but was at the SEC for almost 20 years, she had been working on those rules for an extremely long time, even before Jay Clayton took over the SEC in the last Trump administration. But it was the Trump administration that went forward and actually adopted rules to regulate ISS and Glass Lewis. And as many of the listeners will know, ISS and Glass Lewis are crucial in proxy contests. Why? Because their vote recommendations are highly influential. ISS influences, depending on the company and its specific shareholder base, anywhere between 15% and 30% of the shareholders. And Glass Lewis, it's typically somewhere between 5% and 15%. So regulating these two entities, ISS and Glass Lewis, is certainly something that is delicate from a proxy-fied perspective. And then if you take a step back and look at these two entities, they are private companies that are currently not subject to any meaningful regulation. There's always been the conspiracy theory, if you will, in corporate America that ISS, quote unquote, is owned by the hedge funds. There is a widely held perception, fair or not, that a vast majority of the funding from ISS comes from their hedge fund heavy subscriber base. The reason why I'm referring to this as theory is because, well, nobody knows because it's not disclosed. And that was one of the issues that proxy advisor regulation was trying to address, which is, well, let's find out whether or not ISS and Glass Lewis have conflicts in certain situations. That level of transparency might actually benefit ISS and Glass Lewis in certain situations. But what we heard through the grapevine is that activists are not actually quite all that interested in that level of transparency. And that may be because activists typically need ISS and Glass Lewis recommendations to win a proxy fight. And ISS has actually been very beneficial and very favorable historically from an activist perspective. So now going back to the regulations, so these regulations, actually fairly modest regulations, were put in place in 2020 by Jay Clayton's SEC. Then Biden got elected, Gary Gensler took the chair role at the SEC, and Gary Gensler put these rules first on ice, then he revised them to eliminate a number of key provisions. And the rules have been tied up in litigation ever since. There's actually two litigations out there against these rules. One is against the original set of rules, and then one litigation is against the revision of the rules. And we have contradicting decisions from the Fifth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit. And it's going to be interesting whether the Supreme Court is mainly going to weigh in. But the also an interesting question is, what is the Trump SEC in a second administration going to do about this mess? Because that's what it really is. Right now, it's a mess. And the theories go all the way from, well, they're just going to join the litigation and do anything to get the revisions thrown out and the original rule set to be revived, to they might be scrapping the rules altogether. And that depends in large part on who's going to be the next chair of the SEC, and that is obviously anybody's guess.
Let's keep this thread going with respect to the SEC. So we saw in the Biden administration that the universal proxy card rules were adopted, which were seen as favorable to activists. And I think there's some evidence that this is resulted, for example, in more settlements and things like that. Do you think the Trump administration is going to potentially revisit these rules, Kai, and what changes, if any, should activists expect?
That's a great question, JT. And the universal proxy rules are another example of how company-friendly the Trump administration actually was between 2016 and 2020. The universal proxy rules were originally designed and proposed by the Obama SEC. And then when Trump got elected, one of his first tasks was to appoint Carl Icahn, of all people, as a special advisor on regulation. And a lot of us expected that Carl Icahn would actually push for the adoption of the universal proxy rules. Not so. In fact, what happened is that Jay Clayton's SEC completely disregarded the universal proxy rules and did not adopt them or in any form further their adoption. Only when the Biden administration appointed Gary Gensler, suddenly the universal proxy rules were back on the agenda. It came really as a surprise to many, including SEC insiders, that Gary Gensler made that a focus point of his early administration. And the SEC, after a comparatively short comment period, adopted the rules almost unchanged, notwithstanding the pushback the SEC received from corporate America and law firms like ours. We submitted like a 20-page comment letter. And we had plenty of discussions with the SEC, including two of their commissioners, about these rules. And will not shock you if you hear that the two commissioners we talked to about these rules were both the Republican commissioners who were very skeptical when it came to the universal proxy rules. So we talked to Marco Yeda and Hester Pierce about these rules. And one of the core issues was that the universal proxy rules allow a shareholder to get on a company's proxy card by owning only one share. And I always thought that's just absurd, right? I mean, it's not like you can run for president with only one signature. And you shouldn't be able to get on a proxy card either with just one share. So there should be some meaningful threshold. What we had proposed to the SEC back then was, well, let's just mirror what we did with proxy access, 3%. But the Gary Gensler majority in the commission didn't want to hear anything about it. His attitude apparently was, well, let's just see how it plays out. And as you noted, JT, the universal proxy card has had a significant impact on how activist situations play out in corporate America. There's a widely held belief, fair or not, I think it's not fair, that it's easy to lose a proxy seat or two in a proxy fight nowadays in corporate America. And thereby, a lot of companies feel motivated to settle very quickly. So the question is, though, will the Trump administration revisit that? And I think there is a chance that again will depend on who the next SEC chair is, that the rules may not be rescinded, but they may adjust the ownership threshold. Because currently, I mean, you need more of an ownership stake in a company to submit a non-binding regulatory Rule 14a proposal than to run a proxy fight for board seats. That is a disconnect that makes no sense. The Republican commissioners on the SEC understood that. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next SEC chair is one of the sitting Republican commissioners, that they will take another look at this rule and adjust it accordingly.
Let's turn to some other federal agencies here for a bit. And that's the FTC and DOJ. They've been, the Biden administration, historically aggressive in terms of their enforcement program and their merger review program. And that's really put a bit of a damper on deal activity, which in turn has created some challenges for activists that are pushing M&A transactions as part of their campaigns. Most people think that Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor are on their way out. But specifically, what changes do activists see that they expect they're going to be able to capitalize on during the Trump administration on the antitrust enforcement side?
Yeah, your perception is spot on. I mean, the Biden's antitrust administration was remarkable, to say the least, and has not irritated only activists. It irritated companies just as much. And the Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor pursued an approach to antitrust enforcement that was indeed highly aggressive. They oftentimes brought lawsuits to block mergers, even when they were not expecting to win, which is a significant departure from how any other administration has approached it and has indeed chilled M&A activity across corporate America. And you might then ask, well, why do activists care about it? Well, that's because activists care about M&A. They need a liquid M&A market in order to profit. And the reason why that is because at the end of the day, most activists are looking at M&A as their plan A if they going after a public company. If it's a smaller company in the sub $5 billion realm, I mean, activists are almost always pushing for a sale of the company, either openly or implied. If it's larger companies and mega cap companies, they're typically looking for breakup options and looking for the divestiture of certain business lines. In either case, you need a liquid M&A market and you need to have potential buyers. And if strategic buyers are reluctant to engage in M&A because they fear the antitrust enforcement nixing a deal, that really puts a damper on the entire notion of M&A activism. And when you look at the numbers in the last 4 years, M&A activism indeed went down significantly under the Biden administration. And look, I mean, activists were popping champagne when Trump was elected for that reason alone. It was a real issue that was maybe even more important to them than most other issues. Carl Icahn actually was interviewed on election night, and he was extraordinarily cheerful in pointing out that Lina Khan's days are now over.
Yeah, let's pull off on something, you know, regarding the Sherlin proposals that you mentioned earlier. Again, to your point, the precatory ones under 14A8, you know, we saw that there were previously stricter requirements for these that were actually imposed during the Trump era. For example, stricter minimum stock ownership requirements. Do you anticipate any kind of further restrictions in this area? I know you already mentioned UEDA. He gave a speech recently saying that, hey, we really don't even need this. We should just be following the advance notice bylaws with respect to shareholder proposals. Is there something that extreme potentially in the works?
And what we expect the Trump administration to do in the next go around is to further restrict access to Rule 14a proposals. I don't accept them to scrap the regulation, but I fully expect them to further increase the stock ownership requirements. I mean, let's just be blunt. I mean, not a lot of constituencies care about the proponents of the shareholder proposals. The proponents of the vast majority of Rule 14a shareholder proposals are not actual shareholders who have been investors in that specific company for economic reasons for a long time. No, most of these proposals are put forth by special interest groups who are torturing corporate America with their agenda-driven shareholder proposals. And I mean, look, I'm a European. I have every sympathy for issues like climate change, because unlike in America, in Europe, it's universally accept that the climate change is real, but why do we need to have shelter proposals at companies about that in America is something I personally also never understood. And when you add to that, these proposals in recent years virtually never got a majority of the votes cast, you wonder whether this isn't a gigantic waste of time and resources in corporate America. So I would fully expect the Trump administration to do something about it and hopefully spare our clients this nonsense, at least to some degree, in the years to come.
There certainly has been a big jump in ESG short proposal, and it'll be very interesting to see how climate and other things fare under the Trump administration and just the change in the zeitgeist. Talk a little bit here about some of the non-conventional policies that Donald Trump has advocated that may be disruptive to business. In particular, you mentioned in the article, tariffs and kind of a dramatic and almost unprecedented use of tariffs as part of the policy. How do you expect that this is going to influence activism and these other policies as well?
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, if Trump indeed goes forward with these universal tariffs, it's going to upend the world order in significant part. And that's obviously going to impact a lot of companies in different ways. I think what Trump is missing or might be missing is that a lot of companies are internationally operating, US companies as well, and they could be significantly hurt by trade wars over tariffs. Also, an aspect that is not really being focused on is that a lot of foreign companies are actually manufacturing in the United States. So what has this to do with activism? Activism strives, obviously, in an upmarket, but activism also strives in times of turmoil. That's what we saw during the pandemic. I remember, actually, at the outset of the pandemic, my initial thought was, well, here goes my career. And a few weeks later, it became abundantly clear, oh, no, activists love the pandemic. And not for sure, not because millions of people died. I wouldn't think that even of activists, but because the disruption made for significant market dislocations. And market dislocations is where smart investors, and look, most activist hedge funds are really smart. That's where they thrive. And it also made it more clear which management teams were actually competent. It's easy to run a company during a time of a boom. It's much harder to do that in the time of crisis. And it made it easier for activists to identify the management teams who were clearly not up to the task in this historic pandemic. So I expect that the view of tariffs will be similar if there is significant turmoil as a result thereof.
One last question for you, and we really appreciate your time. Do you expect to see changes in the types of companies that are going to be targeted by activists or activist tactics due to this whole new environment?
Yeah, I think that's where the deregulation comes in. I mean, there are a number of areas of corporate America that have not been targeted frequently by activists, the highly regulated industries, right? Utilities, yes, Elliott has been fairly active there in recent years, but it's still a market that has not had full attention of activists. Insurance is another one, banking, yet another one. If deregulation really occurs, and look, it's easier said, let's deregulate, than actually do it. And I think what we're going to find is that the shiny new intended government agency called DOGE is going to have a significant practical reality to deal with when they're trying to deregulate corporate America. But if they really do it, I'm sure activists will look at some industries that are more deregulated now than before. So that's at least one of the expectations that we have here.
Just occurs to me in our conversation that you know, JT and I both come at this from the public company lawyer background, and that tends to be, you know, very SEC focused. And yes, there are a lot of issues with the SEC and a lot of things that the SEC might tweak that might help activists or or help companies tip the scales a little bit. But in terms of federal policies here, putting aside, you know, tariffs and the disruption and the chaos and that impact on activism, it seems that really the 500-pound gorilla is what's going to happen on the antitrust side of things and the changes to a more conventional approach to merger review and antitrust enforcement. And that's what's going to really be the single biggest factor that's likely to drive activism and promote activism favorably during the Trump administration. Any thoughts on that, Kai?
That is certainly a core consideration for activists. I will say, though, it's not like there was no M&A activism during the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. There still was, because look, a lot of M&A takes place under a threshold that is really of interest of the antitrust regulators, right? I mean, it's a $500 million or $2 billion market cap company is being sold. And it's not a small market where the number one and number two in that market does combining. I mean, these transactions went through without any hiccups. It's just in the large and mega cap space that these kind of transactions attracted more scrutiny, and that scrutiny will go away. So the long way of saying that, I think it depends on what kind of M&A we are talking about. There was always M&A activism, even under Lina Khan. And the question is only, are we going to go back to the quote-unquote good old days where most M&A was fine?
JT, any closing thoughts?
No, I think this is really interesting discussion, because I feel like a lot of people in our world, John, to your point, we think of shareholder proposals, we think about proxy contests. But, you know, I think there's a lot of bigger forces at play here. And Kai did a great job of capturing some, I think, to me, the more macro issues that are starting to resurface. And it'll be kind of a very interesting and exciting time, I think, in the next 4 years as we see all this shape out.
Absolutely. Kai, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it too.